Okay, welcome Rabbi Elkin. Thank you for coming to Contemporary Halacha to discuss the issues of Shechita and Nikra Acharayim in the modern consumer and industrial environment.
So please do let me know if at any point we lose audio or video. I've had it happen before. So relatively new to the whole Zoom thing, as I imagine more or less everyone is, or at least getting used to it. So thank you for your kind words, Rav Orlian. Yes, it's true. I taught in the Mechina program, I believe it was 9 academic years. And all the while I had a meat business alongside as the business began to grow. Parenthetically, as Wayu's benefits began to shrink, I had no choice but to pursue the parnasa elsewhere. And this I mention in the context of full disclosure. So I wanted to be clear that I do shecht and treber for a living. I am not engaged with any of the larger national brands of hashgacha. All of these are very salient details. But most importantly, it allows me to speak apolitically and independently of any affiliations, of any obligations, any requirements, any pressures. And I like it that way. So you're welcome to ask away any questions that you might have. Feel free to interrupt me if you'd like to. There's obviously a lot more information here than I could hope to get across in an hour and 15 minutes, an hour and a half. It won't stop us from trying. So I'll give you as much information as I think I can. And at any point along the way, if you'd like for me to stop, expound upon something, explain something in, you know, greater or lesser detail, it's all valuable information. And it's not just valuable information. There is halachic information. There's going to be some hashkafic information. Never lose sight of the hashkafic importance of what it is that you're doing and what you're involved in. And there's also some industrial knowledge that comes along with it. So there's a difference between, as you should know at this point, not just practical halacha as practiced, but halacha and its practical implications. How things are done, what standards are abided by, or are we trying to live up to? And perhaps the most important question of all, what are the consequences of such standards? And this is maybe no clearer anywhere else in halacha than in kashrut, because when it comes to hitting people where it hurts, so to speak, in the pocketbook, in the purse, in the checkbook, that's where the rubber meets the road in terms of dinei mamonot, hashkafa, and halacha. So with that said, I'll back it up. In terms of shechita, this is the very first Mishnah in Hulin. It's the very first siman in Yoredea. Technically, anyone Jewish can shecht. One of the only areas in all of halacha, in all Arba Chalkei Shulchan Aruch, where even a katan is allowed to shecht for adults as long as someone's mashgiach on him. Incidentally, it's also one of the only places in halacha that we have any such mention of someone being mashgiach, and not as a lechatchila requirement, but as a requirement for those who are in questionable status. So a katan, who's generally considered incompetent when it comes to contracts, acquisitions, different areas of legal, social, halachic importance, a katan can shecht, shouldn't be shechting on his own, beno levin atzmo, but a katan could theoretically shecht for adults too, as could a woman. And the Rama makes mention of some of the later Rishonim having concerns for women potentially passing out at the sight of blood and therefore maybe passing out before the shechita was properly effectuated. The Sephardim have no such concerns. Feel free to consult with your local Orthodox Sephardi rabbi and ask him as to why. But there's such a thing as a dor v'dorashav, right? Every rav knows his kehila. Sephardi women weren't that dainty, and no one had any issues with it. And men ate from women's shechita, and vice versa. It wasn't that big a deal. Perhaps more recently, these items became more contentious, maybe more so even with the advent of the conservative and reform movements. We just don't have time to get into all of it. But the bottom line is, shechita was never relegated to the select few. This isn't Kabbalah. It's not Perek in Dorshin, the second Perek in Chagiga, where you learn about Maaseh Breshit, Maaseh Merkava. It's not that it was reserved only for very unique or special individuals. It used to be something much more commonly practiced. And that's also very helpful to know. I say this because in the trajectory of halacha, the teleology of it, the historic trajectory of it, you'll find that much like just about every other area of halacha, we've tended more and more towards chumrah, for better or for worse. We've tended more and more towards chumrah, and the expectations of a shochet today are not what they used to be, not by a long shot. But that said, anyone who is genealogically, ethnically Jewish, reasonably observant, and even that's a fascinating sugya, and we'll talk about that more if you'd like to, but reasonably observant and at least certainly competent in the five halachot of Shechita, which I'll explain in a second, it's mutter for such an individual to shecht, and such an individual doesn't even require any particular special hashgacha. This is something that Rashi points out a few times throughout the Shas, once by the Kohanim, how Ed Echad Ne'eman B'Yisurim is the sugya. And the sugya is that Kohen Shechting in Bet HaMikdash, even if what he's doing is of national importance, so for example, a Korban Tamid, if it's of individual importance, Hatat and Hasham, etc., there is no requirement, there's no obligation that there be any other Kohen on his back. He can Shecht, and he's Ne'eman to tell you, I Shechted and it was good. I Shechted, the knife was fine, the Ma'aseh Shechita was fine. So not only was my knife appropriate, but the shechita action itself, the mechanics were okay. I shechted enough. I shechted in the right place. And I checked the lungs were fine too. Because a treif is a problem across the board for chulin, for consumption, and also for kodashim. So there's that. There's another example Rashi gives of eating at people's homes. Believe it or not, this was one of these pikuach nefesh type social scenarios where Rashi says, Vadai, you can be samech on someone else, even a woman, shouldn't come to us as a surprise. How do I know that it's mutter for me to eat in my friend's house? So say, for example, a Shabbos meal or a Chag meal. Simple. His wife is ne'emenet, and therefore I can trust her too. You could say she's nogat badavar. Maybe she's trying to impress. Maybe there's tovat hana'ah. Maybe there's all sorts of other things. Nope. You can rely on such individuals, says Rashi, she'im lo kein. No one could eat in anybody else's house. And that's just not possible. So we have a couple of rayas, one of which is basically a metzias. There can be no such thing as a requirement for there to be more than one person. And you have such a comment on the part of Chazal by a cheresh, shote, or a katan. Not even women across the board, just someone who's generally in that famous triad of people who are not considered halachically competent for practically any purpose. And even so, with a mashgiach on board, it's mutter. So where would you find such a scenario? Maybe you have a competent shochet who broke his arm. Tendonitis in his elbow. Sprained a finger for whatever reason, doesn't trust himself to be able to shech. He certainly knows what he's doing. So he can watch someone else and say, hey, how about you pick up a knife? Do as I tell you. Stop when I tell you to. It'll be fine. No harm done. And in such a situation, as I'm going to bring up, listen, this is Torah the way I learned it. You need to know your deoraitas, derabanans, and your minhagim. If it's a chumrah, it's a chumrah. If it's a kula, it's a kula. You have to know where you stand. No conversation can take place in the absence of context. Where's the map? Where do I stand on the halachic map? And so the answer is, why would anybody ever want to trust the shechita of a woman or a child? Well, maybe there's a shochet who's past his prime. Gentleman is 80s or 90s. Maybe his hand's not so steady. Tzibor doesn't know any better, and people accord kavod to him and want to give him deference, but there's a good chance the shechita might not be so great. Important to know that maybe there's a better workaround. Maybe there's someone else who could do this more competently, at least more halachically compliantly, in a way that's more halachically compliant. So the Rama mentions it's a minhag. And say it's usur. He just says that the minhag is such that they don't. Since then, once a minhag is established, how we handle it or we don't is a good question. But it's important to know these things as well. Sometimes you could come up with a scenario where there might be a more competent or at least healthier woman or child than someone who is otherwise theoretically more experienced, but for technical or practical reasons, just won't be able to pull it off. So how is shechita effectuated? What exactly is the definition of shechita? Torah doesn't tell us. Torah tells us not to eat a treifa. Not to eat a nevela. It doesn't define those terms, just tell you not to do it or not to carry them in the case of the nevela. What is it that we are looking to avoid? So how do I avoid eating a treifa? So Shechita, we're told, Halacha L'Moshe Mi-Sinai, consists of five halachot. The Siman Chadash famously gives it the Siman Shohad Ra. Shohad as in V'Shohad Lo Tikach. We'll talk about politics in a minute. But V'Shohad Lo Tikach, this is bribery. Shohad Ra. Bribery is bad. And so your Simanim are going to be Shehiya, that's the Shin, and Lishhot is to pause. We'll talk about that in a second. We'll explain them more in detail as we go, Teniva Azil style. So Shehiya, Halada, which is fascinating because the word itself practically doesn't even appear in the Tanakh. Chulda appears. The Chulda is one of the shrutzim that we're not allowed to eat, commonly associated with the weasel. So I'll explain that in a bit too. Then have Chulda the Neviah, but obviously not what we're talking about. Although it makes a fascinating case for a compelling etymology and what exactly is the Kesher. There must be one. The Dalit would be Drasa, where Drasa is pressing or stepping on something. You have the Resh is really a Gimel. It's Hagrama, but it clings a little better. It sounds better in the Siman. We use the Resh instead. That's okay. We do that sometimes. So Hagrama would be shechting too high or too low. No compelling etymology for that. Girama, you know, to cause something. Garma is a bone, maybe, but the bones aren't necessarily such a good dictator of the upper and lower limits. It's just a term. It's just the term that we use to describe shechting too high or too low, out of place. And then you have ikur, where ikur is basically la'akor. Ikar in Hebrew means a shorish, like a root. So la'akor is to uproot something. And so ikur would be dislocating the simanim or shechting previously dislocated simanim. So I'll explain a little bit more in detail. Shehiya would be shechting with pauses in between. This is the binyan av, incidentally. And you'll find a lot of this in Shechita because it was so common and so practical. This is the binyan av for any pause or any interruption in any mitzvah you'll find. Nowhere else do you find in the entire Shas the definition of a pause that actually disqualifies the mitzvah that you were in the midst of observing or of accomplishing. In Shechita terms, if you were shechting and you paused in the middle of your Shechita or right after the beginning or just before the end, which is a separate machloket, only so much of that we can define in one sitting. If you paused before the Shechita was done, let's say for our purposes, if this pause or a series of pauses that are all mitzvahim, they can all be added up. If the pauses were long enough for you to pick up, knock down, and shecht another bird or behema daka or behema gasa, whatever the case may be, also a whole encyclopedia of discussions. In other words, if you paused in the middle of this mitzvah for long enough that one could have begun and concluded the very same mitzvah during your pause, then the first mitzvah you started is gone. It gets recycled. You can't do it anymore. It's not kosher. And you'll find the Mishnah Berurah talks about falling asleep during Kriyat Shema, about dozing, nodding off during Birkat HaMazon on Friday night. I don't know if any of you guys are married or if you have any kids, but those of you who are might understand a little better what he means. If you're benching and you doze off, nod off, fall asleep, get interrupted for long enough that you could have begun and concluded at least the four brachot of Birkat HaMazon, the first three are Deorata, the last one's the Rabbanan, then your benching no longer counts. You're going to have to go back and start the whole thing. If your pause was for less time than that, you can presumptively continue and assume that the pause wasn't a catastrophic failure. So this is the binyanav. If you shechted something and interrupted your shechita long enough that another whole shechita could have been done and concluded, and you had time for coffee and a cigarette, I mean, the first one's just got to go. It's not considered an active shechita. So that's shehiya, that's the pause. Practically speaking, in the slaughterhouses today, nobody tolerates pauses. The Rima is very, very adamant about this. Mahari Vail is one of the more, Isser V'Heter of Mahari Vail is one of these like foundational svarim in terms of relatively early Ashkenaz Rishonim when it comes to Shechita, Bika, Nikur, etc. So all things Isser V'Heter related pretty much. And he already established, or it was established before his time, that no shehiyah of any kind is tolerated, save for the case of cattle. Cattle are big, they're very powerful, very expensive, and somewhat unpredictable. So everyone, even modern day Ashkenaz shechitas with however many chumras you want to incorporate, no one holds that a shechita keheref ayin is going to pass anything. If you want to get a little bit into the weeds, the Rama's logic that he quotes, Abibidas Maharival, that he quotes there, that how do you define something like a shehiyah? If I'm a big muscular guy and I can pick up and knock down and shecht a goat in a matter of 2 or 3 seconds, maybe 4 or 5, and then some other guy is a little more nebbish and doesn't get much sunlight and doesn't get much exercise and is lacking in vitamin D, it would take him half an hour to pick up and knock down a goat. The goat would pick him up and knock him down before it went the other way around. So this guy can't even punch his weight in the welterweight division. And this is straw weight is what they call this. So the expression that the Rama quotes is, what if Ogmel Chabashan were to pick up and knock down a ram or a goat? It would take him a second. So Rav Yosef Kapach, one of the great Talmidei Chachamim from Teman, who came right off the boat to Eretz Yisrael, I believe in the 50s, his famous Rambam La'am, he went through many Kitvei Yad, his father, his uncle, his grandfather. So his response to that comment was, Lo nitana ha-Torah le'og melech ha-Bashan. If Chazal put it in the Mishnah and left it somewhat subjective, that's okay. It can remain somewhat subjective. Maybe one guy is taller and stronger and does it faster. Okay, some people bench faster, some people read Kriyat Shema in seconds. Doesn't necessarily mean anything puzzled to it. I remember a funny little Milta de Dichuta, but it was a Maise Shahaya Kachaya. It was a good friend of mine, a Moroccan guy. His family had a Megillat Yichus going all the way back to Ezra Sofer. Have a good night, Ramu. And this guy is, like myself, a real fan of Davening B'Hinei Tzachama, Vatikin. So he once made it to one of these minyanim at the Kotel. And, you know, he'd been in minyanim that prayed faster or slower. Sfardim in general aren't such fans of quick tefillah. So he says the whole time, all he hears is, you know, the minhag to read just like the last pasuk or two of a perek. So although he's jumping, skipping, running, can barely make out what they're saying, he's fine. Okay, good. You know, Yishtabach, Kaddish, Baruch Hu, that much he followed. They get to Kriyat Shema, and he is running as fast as he possibly can. And he says, I've never seen anything like this. I'm barely done with Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, and all I hear all around me is tzitzis, 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 emes. So that's it, I quit. Catch the next minute, and I'll start. I just, too much, too fast. So what happens in terms of Shehiyah is that the Sephardim traditionally, again, not practically today, but traditionally, there were two competing Masorot. And it's important to know this. It's important to know, first of all, not everybody holds like you. It's important to know, second of all, that just because someone holds differently from doesn't mean that it's possible, doesn't mean it's Asr, doesn't mean it's Doraita, doesn't mean it's Dorabanan. So it's a Minhag. So you have a Minhag. You have to know the difference between a Minhag and a Doraita. So there were two competing traditions amongst the Sephardim where even the subjective nature of Shehiyah had to be hashed out somehow because the communities were getting bigger, people were traveling, you know, there was they felt more of a need sometimes to standardize. And so one of the traditions was they gave you approximately what we would call today 10 seconds. So Aleph, Bet, Gimal, Dalet, Hey, Wow, Zayin, Chet, Tet, Yod. That's not 10 New York seconds. That's 10 seconds. There was a competing tradition where they had a minhag to hold by the Lashon of the Mishnah. And so the Rebbeim would tell the Shochatim, if you have a question by Shehiyah, Shahat Me'at, V'Shaha Me'at, V'Hazar V'Shahat Me'at. Give you about 7 seconds. So it takes much longer than that to pick up and knock down an animal on average, but that was their way of tightening the subjective screws, if you want to call it that, and trying to keep things a little bit more uniform. It's not to possible anything that took longer than that to shecht. And again, it could be someone elderly, it could be a hefsid and rub, it could be a lot of things. So because Shehiyah is one of those, yeah.
When's that Chalat HaShechita count? Like when do we start counting?
Oh, like when you start, fascinating question. Fascinating question. So hang on to that question for just a minute. I'll walk you through the other four halachot of Shechita. It's going to make a little bit more sense. I could explain it now, but I don't, it's not a sidetrack question. It's an excellent, it's a very shaykh question. We'll get to it in just a second. The beginning and the end of Shechita is really where I would categorize that because there's a machloket on both. Of course, there's a machloket on both sides. It would have been too easy. So what we have is Shehiyah as a pause we already mentioned the minhag by birds is to wait, is not meaning to passel without any shehiyah. The Shulchan Aruch, the Chatchil holds this way, but the Abed says it's okay. You have as much as you have for a daka for reasons that I can't explain now. I could explain if you want me to, but there's a lot of material to cover. By dakot and gasot, we tend to hold more or less along the lines of min bimino. If it's a cattle and you have to take a little bit longer, there's a pause or the thing moved, we might be able to, everybody agrees. A few seconds. What is it? 3-5 seconds, probably at least. In terms of the siman, so we said shehiya, halada. Halada, so a hulda, is how the Shulchan Aruch explains it. Seems like Rashi's inclination. A weasel, just like weasels tend to wind their way in between cracks and crevices. You ever seen a weasel? They're not that much bigger than rats. They're just longer. Polecats is not a related species. So they're all over the world. The mink, a weasel, hermines, another, there's a few other animals in that category. Fisher is a little bit bigger. So they run down the holes of rats, mice, shrews, etc. They hunt them down and they eat them. They're very effective mouse eaters. So they squirm their way in between weeds, cracks, rocks, crevices, you know, cracks in walls, etc. So halada would be stabbing. If you stabbed with a pointed blade, think, now again, everybody has shechita knives today, but back then there wasn't a shechita knife, there was knives. You found what you could, you polished it, you shechted with it. A dagger, a spear, an arrowhead, you know, something. The Gemara says, Dor Melech shechted the arrowhead, so yeah, why not? If you were shechting in between the trachea and the esophagus, right? The two simanim, and we'll talk about that more at length, but the trachea typically sits on top, the esophagus is right below it. The trachea has got these reinforcing cartilage rings around it to prevent it from kinking like a garden hose and being, you know, sealed off so you don't choke. The esophagus is much softer, and there's a much bigger danger. If you puncture the esophagus, food material gets out. Have a good night. Food material will escape, and you'll get septicemic shock very quickly. It just decomposes, causes infection. So the esophagus is more protected. If you stab under both simanim, right? So let's say I stab right above the animals on its back or the birds on its back, and I go over the spine but under the simanim, that's a halada. If I go in between the simanim, and there's a couple of interesting scenarios in the Gemara, even if I go under the skin but above the simanim and then I shecht, so if like I stab the skin from the side but I'm shechting with a concealed knife. A few other cases the Gemara leaves as a teko. If the animal had a really matted wool, if it was stuck, if it wasn't stuck. So you can't stab, you can't weasel your knife in between the simanim. The shechita has to be from the outside in. The dalet for drasa would be kimhatech tzenon, is the language of the Shulchan Aruch there, where radish, potatoes, nobody really slices them, which is what you should be doing for shechita. It's a push cut, you press. You take a knife, you just press down, you chop. Derasa could be also in the language of the Mishnah, kederach shehorgin besayif, right? The way the Malchus used to execute people, not the Jewish one, but they would swing a sword at someone to decapitate him. Look up Saudi Arabia's wonderful criminal justice system if you ever need a reminder of Baruch Shalas Lani Goy, or who we should really be boycotting. So swinging is basically going to cut the simanim. There's no way I could look at a behemah or an oaf and see that you did or didn't do drasa. I mean, I wouldn't know if you chopped the head off or if you only cut the simanim. I couldn't tell by looking at it. But it's enough the Moshe B'Sinai that it's usher and therefore a tarifa by definition. A nevela, sorry. A botched shechita. I meant to mention this before. The definition of a nevela is an animal that dies on its own or a botched shechita or the shechita of a goy, which is also not commonly discussed, but any goy shechting, even if it's a perfect knife and a perfect active shechit, it's always going to be in a vela. So derasa would be chopping. The resh was hagrama. So hagrama is shechting too high or too low. Generally speaking, you want to shecht south of the larynx, the voice box, shipui kova, it's called in the lashon of the Mishnah. And on the bottom end, you're looking more or less at the clavicle. Let's say technically maybe a little bit further in, but that's not terribly helpful or practical. So that's the defined makom shechita. You have the whole length of the neck. Very common myth, by the way, that we don't know where to shecht giraffes, that we lost the masoret, all of which is nonsense. You have easily 7 to 10, 12 feet. You can shecht. I mean, a cheresh otev katan could do this without hashgacha and could get it right. They're expensive. They're violent. They look dopey, but they can kill lions with a kick because they have very long legs and very big hooves. And they swing their heads like cranes. They have these two bony protrusions on top of their heads. So anyone could shecht a giraffe. You just got to catch it first. And you probably have to tie it down, shecht it in an airplane hangar or something. So that's nonsense. Everybody knows how to shecht. It's no different from any other animal. They're just a lot harder to find, and they're not, you know, naturally inclined to be shechted. And they're not easy to raise either. And then ikur with an ayin is la'akur. That's just dislocating the simanim. Much easier to do on a bird than on a behemoth. But if you were to grab the simanim themselves, just the simanim, not the entire head, and pull them so hard that you detach the ligaments that hold them in place, the soft tissue attachments to keep the simanim straight, either you pulled them out of place and shechted there, or you pulled them so hard that they don't retract, they don't recede back to their original position. They're dislocated. You may not be able to see this after shechita. You can. There's a check that you can press on the larynx, and the simanim usually stand at attention if they were properly cut. But that's something that's easier to demonstrate with live bird. I apologize. Only so much I can do via Zoom. But maybe you'll come sometime to the slaughterhouse. We'll have a good time. It's generally everybody, but the subjects in question has a good time at the slaughterhouse. So those are the five simanim. Now back to the question. I remember who it was. Reb Berkowitz, was it? No, who was it that asked me about the beginning, end of Shechita? So how do we define this? Pretty fascinating. It has a lot of really interesting halachic consequences to it. The only way to shecht an animal is to treif it up first. Think about that. If you shechted part of the simanim and then you walked away, got an allergy attack, you know, got an urgent phone call, you're guilty of shehiya. You paused in the middle of the shechita. And if you paused for long enough, the animal would be an avela by definition, because you transgressed one of these five halachot of Moshe Mi-Sinai. Shechita is the act of taking a kasher animal and walking it through the danger zone with your knife, going back and forth, and coming out on the other side with, in the case of an oaf, so birds, only one siman, and according to the Rif, the chatchila, you should be shechting both anyway, but we're mekel that you only need to shecht one or the other, doesn't matter, trachea or esophagus, and it's only the rov. So it's kasher berov siman echad. By behemoth, it's rov shnaim. 51% of both trachea and esophagus is enough. The Ramah would like a rov nikar, maybe 60%. The difference is not terribly great, and usually if that's where you ended up, I mean, you know, you need some practice. So there are discussions that generally speaking, the Ramah is machmir, that shechita begins when you draw blood or break the skin, which for sure is not the din of the Mishnah of the Gemara of the Shulchan Aruch. According to the Shulchan Aruch, it's once you start with the trachea, and even then, until you hit the rov, it's not a trefa yet, and therefore you can walk away and come back. So I could be 49% of the way through the trachea and leave. Come back tomorrow, because the behema or the oaf isn't a trefa. They're, in terms of the trefot themselves, the beginning of the whole third parak of Chulin, elu trefot. And there's high trefot. There are 18 different things that could be wrong with a bird or an animal that would cause it to be a trefa, which means even if it's shechted perfectly, it has some other defect that prevents it from being kosher. So missing your extra limbs or organs, pierced meninges, that's the membrane around the skull, the brain, there's two of them, a pierced heart, any one of the four stomachs in the case of a behema, anywhere in the larger small intestines, majority of the spine is cracked, pierced sheath, what do they call that? The mylar sheath around the spinal cord, etc. The Gidanashe, if it was torn, the Achilles tendon, discussions. The things that the animal can't live without. Generally, not necessarily clear. That's a machlok. So, according to the Shulchan Aruch, shechita didn't start until you're actually the majority of the way through the trachea. Because if it was 20, 30, 40%, it could have been bitten by a fox. It could have been attacked by a weasel, by a hawk, a falcon, a kite, and an eagle. And I could still come and conclude the rov echad, I could cut 2%. I go from 49 to 51%, and now it's all of a sudden kasher. Period. End of story. No machloket. No machloket. According to the Ramah, once you've started drawing blood, even from the skin, already we're nervous about a shehiya. You might have, the esophagus cuts very easily, so even if you haven't cut it, he's concerned. Okay, so that's a chumrah. It's not din Mishnah, the Gemara, the Shulchan Aruch, but it's a chumrah. And this is what it is. That's what's nahog today in the larger slaughterhouses. And again, today animals aren't so expensive that anybody's looking to split hairs over these things. How about, oh, by the way, that also answers the question as to why, according to the Rambam, there is no shehiya in an oaf. Until you cut 50% of the trachea of the kane, which, by the way, is the English cognate for the word cane, because it's stiff, C-A-N-E, kane. Until you cut 50% of the trachea, you haven't even started the shechita, because you could walk away and it wouldn't be a trefa. And by the time you cut 51%, there is no shehiya anymore. You already finished shechting. Here, the Ashkenazim have a chumra where they call it shehiya b'mi'ut batra. Or in more Yiddish conventional yeshivas, shehiya b'mi'ut basra. If you're shechting and in the last minority, which, to remind you, I don't even have to shecht. Everybody holds that if I cut 51% or 60% of bav simanim in a behema, it's a perfectly kasher shechita. According to the Ramah, if I cut through the entire kane, and the veshet is the esophagus, and I cut through 60, 70% of the veshet, then I stopped, and then I went back and shechted, he wants to say that we should be choshishim for a shehiya b'mi'ut batra, even in the last minority, which wasn't even necessary to shecht, but it's still called a ma'isa shechita. And it's possible to do a shehiya even there. If you want some trivia, again, practically today nobody does it, but if you wanted to know some of these fundamental differences between Ashkenazim and Sephardim, it happened to be a lot, and Shechita is not a bad place to find them. So that's Shechita in a nutshell. We have a bunch of other things that we should be covering. Suffice it to say, Shulchan Aruch doesn't hold that way. B'di'avad, Chatchilai says you should be careful. B'di'avad, he's not terribly concerned about it because Shechita was already done. It doesn't necessarily stand to reason that you could still strafe it up, technically be menabil after the Shechita is already done, but He gives deference to such an opinion. You should be careful about it, at least the chatchila. Next up, in terms of shechita, would be checking the lungs. Nobody checks lungs on birds, so I'll save you the long story short. It's very difficult to do also because their lungs are really have a special depression inside their ribs. Really hard to get them out without killing them anyway. But a treif lungs in a bird would be a treifa d'oraita anyway. It's just that we assume al pi chazaka that's not an issue, and generally speaking, it's really not. Avian flu aside, perhaps, but you wouldn't want to eat that anyway. By the way, great reference in the Chulin is in that third parak of Elu Torefot. There's a great line where towards the end of the parak, there's a mission that says that Hikishon Nahash, if a snake bit your behema or your oaf, it's a Nahash Arsi, it's a venomous snake. Some snakes, like pythons, don't have venom, they just constrict or they bite and they kill however they kill. But a venomous snake, Kishira Mishum Torefa. So the snake's fangs typically aren't very long, and they're not long enough to go through the skin, you know, the feathers, the skin, the breast, the ribs, and to puncture the lungs. That's unlikely. And that's the greatest raya I can bring you from a potential few in the Mishnah. Just because it's kasher doesn't mean there's a mitzvah to eat it. There is such a thing as something that's kasher and nasty, or dangerous, or both. So exercise some discretion and some caution. If you've ever been on an airplane, you know what I'm talking about. So, an airplane is some simchas. The bottom line, I digress. Lots of food jokes in the shechita industry. You're checking the lungs. So, what are we checking for? What we're checking for is there's a bunch of things that could be wrong with the lungs, very, very few of which are actually common, except for sirchot. Those are hugely common, and they're everywhere. Sircha, im yichut v'ad sroch na'al, v'lo tomar ani he'asharti et Avram. As Avram Avinu, mi amar el mi, as they used to say when I was in elementary, I don't even know if that's legal anymore, it's probably racist, but mi amar el mi. Avram Avinu says, I don't want imi hut v'ad sroch na'al. I don't want anything from you. Not only do I not want strings, I don't want shoelaces. Look at the midrash. It's the same thing. What's he comparing? Tell me, I don't want an elephant, I don't want a car, I don't want anything in between. So sroch na'al is a shoelace or a bootlace, a bootstrap. So anything that's like a string. Classic machloket, you'll find this in any kosher supermarket. They won't know to explain it to you, but no offense, your local Orthodox Rav probably won't either. Present company accepted, Rav Orlin has been with me to the slaughterhouse several times and he can't explain this to you. Machloket between Rashi and none other than Ri of Zaken in the Tosafot, but then you have apparently Rabbi Natan held this way too, but he's tried to explain it. A sircha is an adhesion, they call this in English. It's basically where you find scar tissue that formed on the lungs. And either attaches, it could be loose, It could be attached to another lobe of the lungs, consecutive or non-consecutive, and I'll explain. Could be attached to the ribs, could be attached to the heart, to the diaphragm, all of which is bad news. Now, people get these things in really exceptional circumstances, usually in places where there isn't much public health. It's not so much a smoking thing, but people just don't get, you know, people who get pneumonia and don't get it treated, it can get really bad. The Gemara has a bunch of shilas on this. It's like Mem Dalet, Mem Hey, and in Chulin. Look it up. It's one of the biggest Tosafot in the entire Shas. Rashi's of the opinion, because the Gemara is not clear, right? How do you hold Basir? It's like, we know they're there. We come across them from time to time. And Rashi is of the simple opinion, period, end of story. An animal or a bird that has a hole, a pierced, you know, any puncture in the lungs is automatically a trefa. Moshe Rabbeinu can't bring this thing back. It's done. Nothing you can do to make it kosher, no matter how you shecht it. Rashi is of the opinion, en sircha belonekev. There's no such thing as a sircha, as a string coming off the lungs. Lungs should be smooth. No such thing as a string coming off the lungs unless there was a nekev. There was actually a hole there at some point. And medically speaking, this is the truth. In other words, there is an infection because the lung tissue is very soft and spongy, at least it should be. If you smoke enough, you can actually cause the lungs to get brittle and crumble. You can crumble them with your hands. So the way Rashi explains it, there was a problem with the lungs, like an infection. The pus became so under such pressure that it just cracked one of the membranes, two membranes around the lungs, pleura, P-L-E-U-R-A. Write it down, you're never going to use it again. But the two membranes around the lungs are those that basically keep the lungs intact and holding air. One of those membranes could be torn and the animal's still 100% kosher according to all opinions. Both of them have to be ripped in order for it to be treif. And if there's a sircha, Rashi explains very simply, there's no such thing as a sircha without a hole. There was an infection. The infection ruptured. And because of the pressure, scar tissue wants to form over the hole, just like it does everywhere else in the body, but it can't. So what it does is it forms a tube. And Chazal knew that sirchas were hollow, by the way. That much they knew. So they knew there was a rupture of sorts. They knew that the sircha is hollow, no matter how thin or thick it is. It's hollow in the middle. And according to Rashi, that's it. Once it had a sircha, kurum she'ala mehamat maka eno kurum. If you have a pierced hole anywhere in the esophagus, in any one of the four stomachs, in the large intestine, small intestine, wherever a hole is a problem, even if the hole healed up afterwards, it's going to be a trefa for the rest of its life. And the same holds for a kohen. Whoever had bariatric surgery, stomach stapling, you know, lap band surgery, anything that caused the piercing, he's a trefa for the rest of his life. And he can't do avoda inside Beit HaMikdash. Fun fact, Yemes Hashem, it should be, you know, halach l'maisa soon, but meaning not that kohanim should get their stomachs pierced, but that we should have such dionim. So in the case of the lungs, if there ever was a hole there, even if there's scar tissue forming over it, even if there's a scab, it doesn't matter. According to Rashi, it's done. And the Gemara itself seems to give two exceptions, Sircha Ledofen Tsar and Sruchot Kesidran. Because if the lungs are attached one to the other by way of a string, it's kind of how they grow. They grow fused, just like ours do. And these dividers start to form. It increases the surface area, makes breathing more efficient. So we have, our lungs are almost identical to theirs. To the animals, that is, not the birds. And so if the lungs are attached, neighboring lobes are attached, you know, one on top of the other like this, and then there's a bit of a crack in between where they're free, but it's in the within the first half of the length of the lobe, everybody holds its kosher, no problem. Ashkenazim is fardim, everybody's happy. It gets dicier where you have sirchot elsewhere, attached to the ribs, attached to the meat, attached to the bone part of the ribs, to the diaphragm, to the pericardium, to non-consecutive lobes of the lung, to the trachea, it could be. Basically, here is where it gets really messy. A little bit of history. In the middle of the 19th century, when you had small kilot of Ashkenazim and Sephardim living together in Yerushalayim, now you always had a Jewish presence in Eretz Israel, and if they didn't teach you this in Hasbara 101, there are families that can trace their yichus back to Qurban Beit HaMikdash, the famous Farjun family that had been in Hebron ever since. Families, lovely from people, been all over the place in terms of Eretz Israel, but they have their yichus together. So you always had little communities of Ashkenazim and Sephardim coming and going, depending on who was being more oppressed and who could make it and who could squeeze out a living and who couldn't. Talmidim of the Gra, the Gra was nifter in Leminyanim 1799. Already a few years prior, he told Talmidim he thought it was time to go to Eretz Israel. You had small Hasidic pockets, you had Sephardim going all the way back to Tzfat before the Arizal, you already had Spanish expulsees, and you had people coming and going from Tveria, from Tzfat, Yerushalayim, Aza had for a while. It's a pretty common Sephardi last name, by the way, El-Ghazi in Arabic. They write it Ghazi with a G, but like Gaza, it's just it was a large community. It was a city, and people lived there. So in Yerushalayim, they had these arguments, because by now you already had the Ramah, who already brought the Chumras of lots of different Ashkenazi Rishonim and Achronim, and this trend towards Chumra went on. And allow me to say parenthetically, many people have the impression the Sephardim are Mekel, and it is much more halachically and historically accurate to say that the Ashkenazim are Mach. The Sephardim are holding like the Mishnah, the Gemara, the Shulchan Aruch, the Rambam for that matter. There's nothing Mekel about it. They're holding like a Svara, a Masoret. That's how it's been. That's how it'll continue to be. The Ashkenazim want to pile on Sfekot or Humrot or accommodate different deis and try to get more Rebbeim on board. That's fine. But relative to the point of departure, that's a Humra. As opposed to the Sephardim deciding to no longer abide by something would be a Kula, which is not the case. In terms of Shechita, the Ashkenazim are actually very, very mekel. I mean, immensely mekel when it comes to glat versus chalak. These discussions started, so you had the Ramah, this is going back to the 16th century, the 1800s, living in Yerushalayim in small pockets. Animals were expensive, parnasa was difficult, and very few people were shechting a behemoth to keep it for themselves or for their family. More often than not, you were splitting it. And they had discussions back in the day about how do you quarter or divide an animal by 8 or by 12 or by 20? I mean, you had plans, cutting plans. How do we hold by the lungs? Only one guy's going to shecht. So the Sephardim would say, okay, as long as the lungs are kasherot, we can eat from it. Kasher, it's kasher. As they started observing each other's shechita, they said, wait a second. We hold that the lungs need to be kshirot, and that there can only be sirchas of two kinds, which all the Rishonim held by, which was sircha ledofen tsar, which is the first five ribs in the rib cage. Take my word for it, their chests are differently shaped than ours. And Rashi holds it because it's tight over there. Even if there was a sircha that could potentially be a nekev, that the space somehow covers for it. So that and the consecutive lobes, which we discussed before. Everything else gets a little bit dicey, and you're talking about a potential deoraita. Let's be honest, Netuvat HaRe'ah appears in the Mishnah. This is an Isur Doraita. Whether or not you hold there actually was a Nekev, what Re holds in the Tosafot, you can look it up. It's a fascinating sugya. He says, it's not that in Sircha below Nekev, it's not that there wherever there's a Sircha, there's by definition a Nekev, a hole. It's that there's not one now, but there will be eventually when it falls apart. And so the way he holds, it sounds like it's only Durabanan. Speaking of Doraita, Durabanan, and Minhag. It's only Durabanan. The Chazal said you shouldn't eat from lungs that have a sircha on it unless it's in one of those two places because of a concern that eventually this will be torn off or broken if the animal coughs or sneezes or whatnot, and the hole is going to be formed, and then at that point it's gone straight. So what do we do? So don't eat it now as a harachaka. And so he wants to introduce this fascinating concept. Maybe if we tear off the sircha and we inflate the lungs and we can prove that the layer of pleura below it is still intact, and therefore the lungs hold air, it should be kosher, and we should be yotzei de safek.
Whose opinion is this?
That's a Ria, but even the Tosafot and Mem Dalid.
That's Ria Hazake. That's the Ria in Tosas. Okay,
I believe so. Yeah, I'm not mistaken. I'm about to go over the sugya again with another group of Talmidim. So it's you'll see there's different opinions there because the Rabbeinu Tam himself tries to explain it, and it's not so clear who's Balashita per se. It seems to have been something of a masoret that at least in France was done. I don't know. The last name like Orlean, you could probably get away with holding by it. So for those of us who aren't familiar, New Orleans is just old Orleans in the New World. Orleans is a French city. So that's pretty gutsy. Honestly, as far as shitas go, it's gutsy. It's basically saying that something that the Gemara leaves no room for is all of a sudden checkable and permissible. Now, the only place that the Shas discusses inflating lungs is where you have a chashash that the animal may have inhaled or swallowed a nail or a needle. And so Chazal said, okay, how do you check that it wasn't punctured from the inside out? Blow them up, put some saliva, put some water, put something on it. If it bubbles, if it whistles, it's damaged. And if not, then not. If Chazal wanted to say that a sircha is a solvable problem, they wouldn't have said it was a Yeah, go ahead. I'll be here for another 15-20 minutes. Have a good night. So if Chazal wanted to say this is checkable, stands to reason that the Gemara would have said so. The check itself, the verification itself is in there, but for a different purpose. Sirchas are so common that it doesn't really sound so logical. Chazal would have forgotten to mention that this is something that we can easily overcome. So this was a big machlokes. Look up the Shulchan Aruch. You don't find this kind of lashon in many places in the Shulchan Aruch, but he says twice in Siman Lamed Tet that this requires a tremendous amount of Yirat Shamayim. He is not happy with it. The Rashba destroys this. He doesn't want to hear from it. Fascinatingly enough, the Rambam makes the following comment. He says, his own opinion, the halacha v'lo lemaaseh, his own opinion is that if you could remove the sircha, betar or bezug, so with a razor, a knife, with a razor or with scissors, if you could check that the layer of pleura on the other side, the other krum, was intact, it should be mutar. Ela shemiyamai lo ra'iti she'osin ken. Except I never saw anyone do this. Not in Cordoba, in Spain, and not in Morocco. And he talks about Shohatei HaMa'arav. Ma'arav is just Maghreb, is the Arabic name for Morocco. So he spent probably more time in Morocco than he did in Spain, ended up in Egypt afterwards. But he's saying, to me, logically, this makes sense, but there is no such Masoret. I never saw such a thing. Not in Spain, maybe Portugal, and not in Morocco. So maybe the halakha v'lo lemaaseh. But it's interesting that you could find a friend in the Rambam saying, if you could take it off and you could prove that the other layer was intact, it shouldn't be an issue. Rashba's not having it. Shulchan Aruch is definitely not excited about this. So this is one of those foundational machlokot. You just have to know it. If you hear people throwing the terms Beit Yosef, Glatz, back and forth, let me demystify some of this for you. Get more in depth if you'd like to some other time. Have a good night. So nobody requires smooth lungs, just to be clear. I mentioned before the Chazal were totally fine with Sirchel Dofen Tzar and with Sruchot Kesidran, the lobes of the lungs. There's two large lobes on the bottom towards the back, towards the hips, three minor lobes on the right, and a small one just off to the right. We have the same thing. And then two minor lobes on the left. If there these attachments happen, they occur in consecutive lobes, it's just how they grow. They start attached and they separate. Ah, there's a funny string in the middle. Write it off. It's okay. Mulligan. When the Sephardim saw the Ashkenazim detaching sirchot or inflating the lungs, they got cold feet. And they said, Rabotai, this gives us indigestion. Doesn't sit with the Shulchan Aruch, with most of the Sephardim Rishonim. Not even with the Rambam, he didn't say you should do it. He just said he thought you might be able to, but never saw anyone do it. It's no such masoret. And to be honest, we're playing with Dilraita fire. This is really a Dilraita issue. There are things that aren't, there are things that are. This is one of those things that are. So they said, okay, we need the lungs to be not only kasher, we need them to be smooth, right? And so the Ashkenazim said, okay. Discussions went back and forth. This is already between Eretz Israel, Hungary, Poland, Lithuania. Later on, Chaim Moshe Gudinsky gets into the picture. So they said, okay. They came up with the standard that they referred to as passable, which is only sirchot benot yoman, a sircha bat yoman, is a sircha that's only one day old or maybe just started forming, but it detaches easily. Sephardim caught wind of this and said, no, we can't have from that either. Shulchan Aruch mentions it, but it's like a yesh omrim, he doesn't like it. So then this other standard developed at the towards the end of the 19th century where they referred to it as glatt. Now glatt is a German word, no offense, Yiddish is German. Glatt in German means smooth. Smooth. So glatz is like someone with a bald head, a cue ball. I speak for myself and present company accepted. But glatz would be smooth, at least in theory. And when some of the shochtim in Yerushalayim started detaching small sirchot, again, benot yoman, if it's a minor sircha, if it's a kesidran, sometimes they said, okay, maybe this glatt concept, they were only machshir up to three. It's really one opinion out of Hungary that holds, I think it's not Beishmuel, I forget the name of the sefer. It's just one sefer, everybody points to the OU has it on their website. I forget the name, escapes me for the moment. Somewhat random and arbitrary, why three? According to the Ramah, he only uses the term kasher. He's not crazy about the minhag. Look it up in Siman Lamed Tet, towards the end. It's a long siman. Towards the end, the Ramah said, look, that's the minhag. It is what it is. We shouldn't be doing this. We shouldn't detach and inflate. We shouldn't detach sirchot and inflate lungs. Certainly not on goats and on kids and on lambs or on young calves. He doesn't give a definition for it, but he says if it has a sircha at that age, it's never going to make it. He doesn't like the minhag, but he says this is the minhag. It is what it is. So You have to learn how to read these things. The fact that everybody today does it doesn't mean that everybody was crazy about it then. Look up Kitniot, you want to have such a discussion. Again, how you practice is one thing, but look at the original opinions that were there. It's really interesting stuff. So that's when the Sfarim got a little bit impatient. They said, look, it doesn't matter if it's 1, 2, 20, or 30 sirchot. If there's sirchot that you hold are mutarot for you, then eat them. But if we're going to be relying on each other's standards, we request chalak. Chalak meaning smooth. When the Sefaradim say chalak, it means completely smooth, like no sirchot. At least it used to. Come on, politics are politics, guys. Nobody's protected from this. So what ends up happening? Today, in large-scale industry, when even small-scale industry, when someone says kasher, what they mean is kasher with no restrictions. Meaning, however many sirchot there were, we tore them off, we inflated lungs, they held air, zero. That's like Rabbanut Tel Aviv. They're holding like the Ramah. They're holding just like the Ramah. The Ramah makes no pretensions to be any more machmir than this. That's what the Am holds by. It's a Masorah. That's how we hold. That's how we hold. You want to be more machmir? Be machmir yourself. Incidentally, I can tell you now, especially post-mortem, but I met the Shochet of Rav Eliashiv, who, for many fascinating reasons, happens to be a lovely guy, wore a big, beautiful kippah saruga. He learned Shechita by Rav Yehuda Giat, by whom I learned Nikur as well, and Mila. And Rav Eliashiv was machmir for the Bet Yosef. I don't say this because everybody should. I don't say this because everybody shouldn't. I say it because he did. Just because it wasn't necessarily the minhag everywhere, or just because it wasn't necessarily the standard practice, doesn't mean that Hasidim v'anshei ma'aseh thought that it was wise or worthwhile to roll the dice on, you know, offending some of the Rishonim that weren't necessarily less important than some of the other ones. So I'm not saying everybody should or shouldn't. I'm just saying that's a ma'aseh that I happen to know because I met the man and I know what he held from what he didn't. He was very makbid about this. The whole family together, they would split a cow every so often, at least 3/4 of a cow. And Rav Eliashiv would take only from what was Beit Yosef from this particular show. He had beautiful knives, this guy. But he was getting paid peanuts. It was like 250 shekel a day or something. So he went into chinuch. I'm talking about going out of the frying pan into the fire. Rolian, don't comment on that. So the long story short is that what used to sound nice, you know, halak, glat, everybody arguing about who's more machmer than everybody else. Today, kasher just means kasher. It just means that there's, you know, there were sirchot, they were removed. That's about the extent of it. You had whether or not they were certain kinds or others, when they say glat, technically, the original Hungarian, if there was, I can't even call it the original minhag. As the minhag was established, it was an attempt to distinguish themselves. Remember, this is the time that Hasidus was really catching on. So in an attempt to distinguish this practice, which the Ramah is not terribly crazy about, don't take my word for it, take his, and there's definitely strong opposition on the part of the Sephardi Rishonim, the attempt to distinguish themselves and to say, okay, we're going to hold from a slightly higher standard. It's not that these sirchas are kosher, those aren't, but we're going to minimize it to 3 max. 3. I have 5 fingers, but that's 3. 3 max. That means they want them relatively close together, you know, not too dispersed. Think tzeta kochavim, different shitas and how kochavim, benoniim, ktanim, gdolim, if they're close, if they're not close, but it's arbitrary. It's just something that came up as a way of distinguishing accepting everything to accepting less. Glat offended Sfarim because there were definitely sirchot that the Shulchan Aruch would reject with b'shtei adayim, with both hands. And so they were holding by Beit Yosef. Now, technically, Beit Yosef could be that you have really bad sirchot by the upper 5 ribs where the lungs are stuck to the rib, or sirchot kesidran. The Ramah, alternatively, insists that every sircha has to be taken apart and inflated. And it could be that something that wouldn't pass the inflation test was totally fine by the Gemara and fine by the Shulchan Aruch too. So technically, there is an overlap where the Ashkenazim could potentially be more machmir than Sephardim. It's maybe 5%, it's maybe 10, it's not much more than that. And then when they say halak today, what they really mean is Beit Yosef.
Sorry, Rabbi Elkin.
Yeah.
Well, what's that case that you just, could you repeat that last case where Sfardim, where Ashkenazim potentially, yes, could be more machmir?
Very important, and equally important to know that it's maybe 5%, maybe 10. I'm just putting that out there for statistical purposes. I'll talk a little bit more about that too. The Ramah wants every sircha to be taken apart and checked. He's not machshir stam. I mean, obviously we're playing with fire because a nekuvat ha-re'ah, if there is a hole, even a pinhole in the lungs, it's a trefa de oraita. So the Ramah says, we are going to be machmir that every sircha, even if it's in a place that the Gemara itself approved, like a sircha ledofen tzar or a sruchot kesidran, we have to detach it and blow it up and make sure it holds air. Whereas the Gemara never required this. The Rambam, the Shulchan Aruch never required this. The Gemara was totally accepting of these two kinds of sircha. It doesn't even care if the sircha was as thick as your finger. And if you took it out, you could hear the thing whistling and bubbling, which raises a separate machloket, also equally fascinating. What happens if a Sephardi guy cuts it off or takes it off? Is it mutter because you're like relying on a rov, relying on a chazaka, and all of a sudden you blew it, and therefore you have nothing else to rely upon? Or is it mutter anyway, because who cares? So you don't want to get yourself in that kind of a position. Today, halacha lemaise, ask your local Orthodox rabbi. But the Sephardim definitely didn't check these things and had no interest in it. And so in theory, there's an overlap. To be clear, the percentages of Bet Yosef in today's large-scale cattle shechting, let's call it like the American industry, Bet Yosef, 5%, 10%, on a wildly good day, maybe 15, from a really good farm, maybe 20. Much closer to the 10% mark, and maybe less, and sometimes nothing. And I want to be clear for a number of reasons. Number one, as the great Jim Morrison once said, no one here gets out alive. Anybody who claims they have a shita they can explain from beginning to end, and there's no machloket, no argument, it's a nichtzei tzon barzel, there's no way you can disprove my shita. Everybody has difficulties with their shitas, you know, vis-a-vis different sugyas and different chazakas and different realities for a variety of different reasons. If you're pointing at the modern cattle industry and you thought for a second that everybody could live off of Beit Yosef today, you're crazy. Crazy. There is no industry anymore, if that's how you're trying to hold. So Baruch Hashem that we have different traditions, Baruch Hashem that we can all, one way or another, rely on each other and get along, because if we couldn't, no one could possibly sustain a kosher operation, shechting only, you know, surviving on 5, 10, 15% of the shechita. That's just not feasible. And let alone the hindquarters. We'll talk about that. We have a few minutes. So, it's very important for us to understand these things and to know that the reality is what it is. Perhaps back in the day when they weren't raising such large quantities of cattle, the density of the livestock, the load of livestock per acre wasn't as high. These sirchas weren't as common. Typically, they are bacterial, viral, fungal, or parasitic infections. Protozoans, you have worms, you have, you know, beetle larvae, all sorts of things. These animals graze on the ground, so they have very large lungs. Cattle do anyway. They inhale a lot of potential pathogens, and the occasional bug, worm, beetle makes it up their nasal cavity and into the lungs, and they'll just bore their way out if that's what they want to do. So the percentages aren't that great. On the whole, it must be said, the Sephardim represent a much more strict approach to lung checking. And it would only be in those cases where a Sircha Kesidron or a Sircha Ledofen Tzar wouldn't pass the detaching and inflating test, that the Ramah could potentially be more machmir than the Beit Yosef. You're talking about, like I said, maybe it's 5%. Because even those cases where there is a sircha, if it's not that bad, it would pass anyway. And nobody would have an issue with it. That would actually fly as chalak. That would fly as chalak today. Yeah.
Well, why did you say that you don't find, because we always, meaning only 10% of the animals are gonna pass by according to Beit Yosef. Is that what you said?
Today, if you're holding like the Beit Yosef, you're going to end up with somewhere between 5 and 15% of all the cattle shechted in North America. I got this from CRC. Well, no, Beit Yosef. Beit Yosef. CRC, RK, and OU have all. What's that?
You're only going to have 10% of the animals that qualify like Beit Yosef?
Give or take, sometimes 5, sometimes 10, 15. Again, it'll differ from one group to the other. As we say amongst Shochatim, V'revach tasimu ben eder u ben eder, like Yaakov sending his gifts to Laban. You got to distinguish between one lot and the other. Sometimes they come in much worse, and they usually tend to contaminate each other. These things do spread through herds of any animal or even birds. So glat, you're looking at probably somewhere around 55%, 60% would be considered a good day in glat. And since Beit Yosef would be a subset of that, what you're looking at is probably all in something like 50 to 60% kosher bichlal, which brings me to another discussion. Feel free to continue if you have a question. We'll talk about the hindquarters before we're done. How much longer do we have, Rabbi Leon?
Until 6:30.
Oh, 6:30. Okay, good. I thought it was 6 and change. Good, good. So we have to go ahead. I'm sorry, I didn't see your name, but whoever I interrupted, feel free to ask the question, Kevin.
That was fair. And the Chumar Rabbi Yosef was the sircha in the lung, or he was more machmir with the sircha of the lungs. Is that what you said?
Wow. According again. To Yosef. No, my knives are sharp. Habibi, we're going to be very, very medayak in what we're going to say here.
Of course.
The Chumra of the Beit Yosef is not a Chumra. It's the Rishon, the Sephardi Rishonim, and their take on Ikar Hadin from the Mishnah and the Gemara. The introduced Kula, if you will, comes from the Tosafot. And here we're talking about something the Gemara itself refers to as Treif, and being able to be Machshir it by tearing it off, verifying that the layer of membrane, there's two membranes on the lungs all around, so one of them is not dispensable, but in the event of an emergency, you have a backup. So it's tearing off the one and demonstrating that the one, the interior one, the one that's below it, is still intact, in which case, at least in theory, it should be kosher. Incidentally, why the Sephardim don't hold from that has a lot to do with what we just said about Kurum Shala Mehamat Makah Eno Kurum. The membrane, if it's only intact because it was fused or sealed over by stitches, by a scar, by a scab, then it's not considered a membrane. And so according to the logic behind this shita, which is just how it always was for geographically most of the world, the Ashkenazim really concentrated to, you know, a relatively small geographical area, is that you can't prove to me conclusively that if you tore off one layer of the membranes, that the layer below it is intact from the very beginning. It could be that you had a problem that went through both of them. And now it's scarred over, but there's no way you could even check that. So according to the Beit Yosef, that's the logic behind, I mean, he doesn't say it explicitly, it's just push it to the Shita, that there's no checking it because there's no way you could check it. All you can check is that the lungs hold air now. You can't check that the lungs held air before, or that they were never punctured and didn't scar over and now have the appearance of being intact. So the Kula there, so the Beit Yosef is basically saying, I'll only accept the sirchas that the Gemara itself accepts. He quotes as a yesh machshirim two or three other things, like these little tiny sirchas that might have formed within a day, sirchas that you can shake free or that you can lift with a finger and they detach. He doesn't care for it. He says, there are those who are machshir. It doesn't sound like he's terribly crazy about it. Kabi b'di'avad, yes, chachila, no. But the Rama, on the other hand, his chumra vis-a-vis the Beit Yosef Shita is that no matter how big or small, every sircha has to get checked. And so you could have a really nasty sircha that the Gemara is matir and the Shulchan Aruch is machshir, and they're even that I want to check. And if that doesn't pass the inflation check, even though Chazal might have accepted it, we're not going to. But those cases are rare because it would have to be a sircha that's in the right place and so thick that the Spartan would be afraid of checking it, and the Ashkenazim would say we have no choice but to check it. And so that's what I'm saying. About 5%. Come with me to the slaughterhouse one day. You'll see this in high definition, high resolution. You'll never forget it. You'll never forget it. But it is one of those areas where it's a Venn diagram. It's not a black and white, who's Machmer, who's Mekya. It's a mess. On the whole, the Shulchan Aruch is about 4 or 5 times more Machmer if you want to count statistically. And that brings me to another question. Are you done with your question? I want to interrupt if you still have something on mind. Yes, no. So the other question that would bring me to is the economics of it all. Anybody who tells you that halacha lives in a vacuum is an am ha'aretz. Anybody who tells you, this is someone who has just no experience in life. What's the Gemara? In Masechet Sota, a beautiful expression about this, that, you know, karav v'lo shana am ha'aretz. Karav v'shana v'lo gamar am ha'aretz. Karav v'shana v'gamar v'lo shimesh v'tzorko. Learning Mishnah, Gemara, and Tanakh, it's all great. Until you have real-world experience, you know nothing. You don't understand any of it. So you actually saw a couple go through a divorce, or saw a couple bury a child, or, you know, you saw someone with a difficulty in Parnassa with neighbors. Well, what do you know? You read some news. So the economics of it all. If we were all to hold from the Beit Yosef and be eating 10% of the cattle that were shechted kosher, it would be a disaster. And what I mean by that is Akash Baruch Hu works things out. It's fighting for about 10% of the American Jewish population. It kind of stems with the percentages. So maybe it's Akash Baruch Hu, call it Ashgacha, call it a sense of humor. Not everybody could be eating from it. It just wouldn't work out. It would be crazy expensive. There's another sugya, and this isn't even a machloket between the Beit Yosef and the Ramah, and that's the whole concept of Nikur HaHoraim. Okay. I sent you a link in the Zoom chat. It's a link to a, I copied over a PDF. You could look it up in the original, the Igrot Moshe. Rav Moshe Feinstein was asked about Nikur HaHoraim here in America, not in the former Soviet Union, not in Eretz Israel, here in America. What should we do with the hindquarters of the cattle? You know, we used to be menachah these things in Chutz Laaretz. There were a few places where they didn't, but everybody else did what they could. Of course, we had a tradition, save for some minor differences. And Rav Moshe is gushing. Absolutely. We should be doing this to keep the Masoret up. Even if it's only for minimal profit, just for the fact that we have a Masoret and we shouldn't lose it, we should be doing this. So much the more so when it has an impact on the economics. What do I mean by an impact on the economics? Well, gentlemen, let me walk you through some arithmetic. I shechted 100 cattle today. Of my 100 cattle, 10% came out Bet Yosef. And let's say I got another 50%, 45-50% came out glatt. Let's be frum. Let's call it 50% total came out kosher. If I'm only processing the four quarters, loosely defined as everything from rib 12 and on, the cattle have 13 ribs like we do. And so from 12 and on, 12 and up towards the head would be called the anterior section, the front-facing section of the animal. Everything from 13 and on back would be from the hindquarters. The Rama makes no mention of any chorma here. Literally not once does the Rama say, the Sfardim hold that way, but we don't. No machlokot, no arguments, no debates, no discussions. A few things the Germans were a little careful about on the actual stomach, and today who eats stomachs? I wish we did, but USDA is more of a problem there than kashrusness. So Rav Moshe is super encouraging of this. Absolutely, you should do it. You should find a way to get it done. We should keep the Masoret alive. If I shechted 100 cattle and only 50 of them came out glatt, let's say, and of those 50, we're only using the four quarters, technically it's 25% of the net yield of kosher meat that's leaving my slaughterhouse with a glatt stamp on it. And that means that the price that that commands on the kosher market has to sustain the entire business, because the goyim don't need my favors to shecht cattle. They can do it cheaper. They don't check knives. They don't check lungs. They hit it in the head with a pneumatic pump that fires out a quarter-inch bolt, supposedly to the conscious center of the brain. I can guarantee you that the Mexican guy behind that bolt is not a PhD doctoral student. He's some dude who gets paid $11 an hour if he's lucky and experienced. And he's just sitting there banging 2,000, 2,200 bolts a day. I mean, in theory, if the guy were a neurosurgeon, he would be disrupting the conscious center of the bovine brain. Now, that's measured, generally speaking, by the absence of voluntary muscle movement. So no eye movement and no vocalization. The cattle don't moo after they've had a bolt through the brain. Now, if you were to ask me, would I prefer a knife to the throat or a bolt to the brain? I would politely decline. I don't think there's a happy or a nice way to kill animals. And let me disabuse you of the notion that shechita is the most pain-free way to kill an animal. There's no nice way to kill anything. We do it because it's mutter. We do it because the Torah tells us this is how you have to do it if you want to eat from the thing. There's no mitzvah to kill animals. If you want to eat it, you have to shecht it. That's all. So I don't know that we're winning any humanitarian prizes. I don't care for humanitarian prizes. I'm looking to win them. This is how we shecht. This is how we do it. Find me all the scientific evidence you want. But if that's the card game you want to play, eventually you're going to get trumped, to use the bridge terminology. Eventually someone will demonstrate with electrodes, with EKG, ultrasound, you know, we can determine that the cattle suffer less when they're killed this way than that way, and then you're up a creek because you won't be able to prove it. That's not the game we're playing. It's not the argument we're trying to win. Economically speaking, if I have a kosher business and it costs me more to process each cow, probably twice as much, as it does to for a geisha place to process their way, there's no reason they shouldn't, then I'm selling my treif cattle at a loss, which means 50% of my whole cattle and the hindquarters of the 50% that did come out kosher, which yields about 75% goes to the treif market on a good day, 70. That's why kosher meat is expensive. It's because your kosher meat isn't just paying for the cow that they shechted and gave a thumbs up to, and it got a stempel, it got a stamp. It's paying for the entire operation and trying to cover the losses of the non-kosher meat that sells on the treif market for the same price everybody else is paying for treif. You're not going to get any extra points. Maybe you sell to the Muslims and you get another 5 cents a pound. You're not going to save for your kid's college tuition on 5 cents a pound. So there's a very compelling argument to be made, not for reinventing the wheel, not for making things up, for holding by Masoret, for holding by our tradition, for holding like Rav Moshe. The Eretz Yisrael, they do this. No reason they can't. And there's no reason they shouldn't. So read the tshuva, you'll see it. The idea behind the Nikur and what I've decided to dedicate much of my life to, that and writing Gittin, but that's a really morbid occupation. Let's be honest, the slaughterhouse is a lot cleaner, neater, easier. Probably smells better. When it comes, less political, Reverie, you'll tell me when to stop. When it comes to...
you're going to just back up just to describe what the word Nikur Acharayim is very basically.
Okay, that's where I was going. So, Nikur, Haine Hanashim Hahem Tenaker Lona Ale. Right? You have this by Datan and Aviram, the whole story of Korach Vadato. Lenaker in Hebrew is to gouge out or to pull out. So, if you're wearing really fancy, glitzy jewelry, it's Menaker Enaim. It causes people's eyes to pop out like, wow, look at that diamond. Such an amazing thing. And it's the art of Nikur is just the art of removing whatever is asur from a carcass. So it's arteries in terms of dam, the isur of dam. On one foot, their dam falls into four categories. There's dam hanefesh, that's the dam that with which the nefesh evacuates the body. The animal's no longer alive by virtue of its dam hanefesh no longer being there. That's the thick arterial blood that comes out. It doesn't come out when you slice the trachea or the esophagus. What you're looking at, let's say this is the trachea and this is the esophagus. You have the jugular veins and the carotid arteries are both right on top of each other off to the side. It makes like a diamond shape. So it's practically impossible to shecht without hitting at least one side, if not the other. The carotid arteries are the arteries that go from the heart directly to the brain. And like any good plumbing system, there's the jugular veins are on either side of the throat. They're the return. Right? This is why things like blood chokes in UFC are so effective. Until you deprive somebody of oxygen, it can take him up to a minute or more to pass out. But stopping the flow of blood, you can do it in 15, 20 seconds. So if there's no blood going to the brain or coming back, you're in trouble. A proper shechita, generally speaking, opens this up. It's not a requirement for the shechita. It's just a requirement for the dam. We don't have time to get into that. The blood is going to be pumped out by the heart and the system is going to drain itself. And so the dam that leaves while the heart is still pumping is dam hanefesh, asur bikarit. Bad idea. I've been to a slaughterhouse. I've seen people collect it and drink it. It looks like some Aztec psychopathy from whatever, but people do it, I tell you. Then you have blood pudding, boudin noir. The French have these blood sausages. I don't make these things up. People do it. Then you have the dam be'ain, which is blood that's coagulated inside the heart, the ventricles. You'll find some inside the liver, inside the spleen. Organs are very heavily irrigated with blood. Dam be'ain is a surah d'oraita, but it's only b'malakot. So who doesn't like a lash from time to time? 39 for every kazait that you eat or drink. Usually it's coagulated by the time you skin and gut the animal because blood doesn't like sitting in one place for very long. That's why the kohanim have to be mimares. They have to mix the blood they catch from kabbalat adam, from korbanot. Then you have dam ha'ivarim. You have the blood that's absorbed in the organs and the muscles themselves. Dam ha'ivarim breaks down into two categories. Dam ha'ivarim sheperash is also a surah d'oraita. So if you squeeze blood out of a muscle, or if you salt a muscle and catch the blood that comes out, this too, a kazait of it, or a revit kos, if you're drinking it, be a surah d'oraita. Dam ha'ivarim shelo perash is mutar, even d'rabanan. There's no issue with it. And so the only issue with eating raw meat is that you would have to wash it. You have to take a slice of meat. You want to eat like a filet mignon, you know, tartare sashimi. Every cut surface has to be washed, dried off afterwards from the water. But that's how you can eat raw meat if you'd like to. Otherwise, you can salt it, and you can salt it in big pieces with fat and bone on it. I mean, no salt makes it into the meat. It is what it is. And in that case, you're allowed to eat it too. So this is just in terms of the shechita process. Because of dam ha'ivarim, we have to salt the meat. That's a discussion for another time. Because of dam be'ain, which is blood that's still visible with its own natural color to it, we have to remove arteries from the either side of the throat, behind the ear, along the jaw. There's two arteries in the tongue. There's two arteries, the brachial arteries, along either side of the arm on the inside. They're protected from predators that way. There's two arteries in the legs that aren't mentioned. And the femoral arteries are two of the biggest arteries in the body. The only reason that they're not mentioned is probably because it's almost impossible to get the Gidanasha out without at least nicking them. Here's another fascinating machloket between Ashkenazim and Sephardim. In Eretz Yisrael, this actually, by the Ashkenazim, was also machloket, because Rav Kook went back, and his response was that here in Eretz Yisrael, everybody holds the way that the Rashba held in Spain, and Sephardim held ever since, was that veins and arteries only need to be cut open so that the blood can come out when it's salting or when it's roasting. Other than that, he held that there's no technical requirement to remove them in their entirety. Rav Chaim Ozer once said in Lithuania, apparently Russia, it was done that they removed them in their entirety. And so it seems to be a minhag today, more or less, that in Chutz La'aretz, the Ashkenazim take out the veins and arteries in their entirety. And in Eretz Yisrael, neither Ashkenazim nor Sephardim do it. But that's a discussion for another time. Other items that have to be removed in the course of Nikur, just removal of things that have to come out. The heart has to be opened so that you can flush out the blood. There really are chunks of blood in there. In a cattle heart, it could be quite a bit, much more than a kazait. The lungs, often enough, the animal inhales blood when it's gasping for air after its trachea has been severed. And so it acts like a vacuum and it pulls blood into the lungs. You got to open them up, at least cut the lobes apart from each other. Not that hard. The liver has arteries that have to be removed, very heavily irrigated with blood. So that's either you open it, you cut shtiba erev, according to Shulchan Aruch, just nick them across. Another good example of not everything having to be removed. And then you have the Gidan Hashem, which applies only to behemot and hayot, but not to birds. And it applies Chutz La'aretz, Eretz Yisrael, and it applies right leg and left, makes no difference. And you have to remove the Shuman Hagid. The language of the Gemara is Shomno Shel Gid, Yisrael Kedoshim Nahagubo Isur. So the fat around the sciatic nerve, which is just the nerve, the main nerve that runs down both legs, and it innervates all of the muscles in your leg, it has to be removed. Different branches of it, that's also some separate discussion about Ashkenazim and Sephardim, but you're talking about relatively minute details in the grand scheme of halachic things. The fat that accompanies the gid is also removed. You basically have to open up the legs, respecting the, you know, shape of the muscles, just get in between them, open the butterfly, so to speak, and so to speak, remove the nerves and the fat that's on them. And the chalev. And the chalev is the abdominal fat. Most all of it is behind the diaphragm. Some of it's a little bit ahead of the diaphragm. The hanger steak, if you ever had one, the crura, it's this two-part muscle with a tendon in the middle that actually pulls on the diaphragm. So it's the muscle, muscles only contract. So it's the muscle that pulls the diaphragm back, creates a vacuum, and that's what we call breathing. And then it releases it, and it allows you to exhale. And so that muscle happens to be totally covered with chalev on both sides. Ashkenazim eat it, they just clean it, which is what the Sephardim do for the rest of the behemoth too. The liver has some chalev on it, it has to come off. The skirt steak has a krum, the peritoneum has to be removed. So the skirt steak is the muscle, the diaphragm muscle. It's the muscle that tensions the diaphragm uniformly. So if you're breathing more out of one nostril or the other, you'd end up damaging your lungs or damaging the diaphragm. This is the one that goes around it like a rainbow and sort of keeps it uniformly tense as the hanger steak, the krura, is pulling on it. And then you have the fat inside the abdomen. All the intestine fat is kosher except for the first and last amma. That's only because the rectum itself sits in the pelvis. The pelvis is totally caked in chalev, as is the lower back, the lumbar vertebrae. And that's where the tenderloin sits, the famous filet mignon, covered in chalev. What do? Take it off. Take it off. You can eat it. Not a big deal. Not the chalev. You can eat the muscle. There are some nerves in the stomach, the peritoneal nerves. That's what innervates the stomach. So, you know, three nerves on the right side, two on the left, really three, but one of them, I mean, the Gemara says it's mutter, but take it out anyway. That's pretty much it. There's chalev on the kidneys, but it's all basically one big fat body in the abdomen. And so the intestinal fat is okay. The stomachs, all four of them have to have the fat removed. One part of the final stomach, which is the one that's most similar to ours, is technically mutter, and nonetheless, midrabanan, we move it, or mitam minhag, we remove it, not that big a deal. And matnot kehuna would be two of the joints on the front right leg. It's a machloket Rambam and the rest of the world never seemed to bother him, but it's a machloket which two joints it is. According to the Rambam, it's the two lower joints that have very little meat on them, just the shank, and what would be the equivalent of our carpals. And the sorry, the metacarpals. And according to the Shulchan Aruch and the rest of the Rishonim, it's the forearm and what would be the equivalent of our bicep-tricep combination. The lower jaw with the skin on, they could make whatever they want out of it. Good luck with that. And the tongue inside it. So that's the cheek and the tongue. Tongue and cheek. Menacher joke. Not well received. And the keva, the last stomach. The Midrash says this is thanks to Pinchas. He took a lance in his arm, and assuming he was right-handed, that's why those two joints are part of Matnot Kehuna. And he stabbed them, right? He stabbed the woman into the cavity of her body. But like a kiva, like her stomach, literal stomach. So therefore he gets that. Midrash says that he also made a tefillah before he did it because he knew that this was pikuach nefesh. So if they turned around and killed him, there'd be no din, no dayan. So apparently his tefillah was what got him the jaw and the tongue. Incidentally, purely Ashkenaz minhag, quoted by the Mordechai, to have the head of an aisle, the head of a ram, as one of the simanim at Rosh Hashanah. It's not mentioned in the Gemara. Simana milta, that's the whole deal. It's like these things you should have on your table. And for some reason, it's a German custom. The Spartan took it and ran with it. And I don't, you can't even get Germans to put a fish head on their table anymore. But you'll refer back to the beginning of the discussion where the Ashkenazi and Sephardi women apparently have different proclivities when it comes to sensitivities and sensibilities at the risk of editorializing. So other than that, that's it. The practice of Nikur never, it was always done by women. Overwhelmingly, anyway, people shefted, especially in hot climates. They just hot potato, you know, shefted, cut the thing up, and hand it to your wife, take it apart. They had names for these different muscles. They knew what had to come off and how it had to be. So Morocco, Afghanistan, you know, Uzbekistan, Persia, Yemen, Syria, Hungary, Poland, Russia, same thing. Plenty of sugars in the Gemara. You find them in Chagiga, you find it in Chul, and you find it in Shabbos. You know, about the importance of giving your wife time when you send her meat at Erev Shabbat to properly remove the chelev and the gidim before she cooks it. Otherwise, she could be machshel other people. So I got to be careful about that too. But otherwise, it's always been done. Never stopped. There's a few places. Apparently, the Hatam Sofer didn't like how the Nikur was done by him. And so he asked a few people to stop, or he only wanted certain people doing it. That eventually spread to a few other pockets in Europe where they just didn't have menachrim or they didn't teach them. Quite possibly, it was just economically speaking, it was, and there was enough industry. The cities were big enough that they could just shecht by the goyim, take what they wanted, and not deal with things they didn't want to deal with. But at the end of the day, that's more or less how it ended up developing. The overwhelming majority of Ashkenazim did Nikur, didn't have an issue with it. They came to America. The cattle were cheap. I'll leave you with a very interesting note.
Can I ask you a quick question?
Yeah.
Quick question. You said that one of the matnas kahuna was is the lechi, which includes the tongue. So how do we eat tongue?
How do we eat the tongue?
Never, yeah, isn't tongue part of the Matnas Kahuna?
Oh, so how do we not give Matnas Kahuna today? It's a good question. So two things to it. Number one, there's a machloket. Oh, sorry. Number one, there's a machloket between the Radbaz. Basically wants to say that Matnas Kahuna and Chutz La'aretz, it's not so clear that the Kohanim today have the same yichus that they used to. It's a drara de mamona. You have money. It's not clear who it belongs to. You know, takafo kohen, right? Does a kohen even have the right to come? It's mamon shen alav tovin.
So it's not an isser. It's not an isser achila like truma, for example. Right. It's only a mamonis.
It's technically a chiv on the gavra to give it. It's not an isser on the item itself. It's not a heftz. It's a gavra thing. If you want to call it that, here we're back to Lithuanian Rav Chaim Zagrodinsky. But yeah, if you'd like, otherwise you have the Mishnah that says that if Obed Kochavim was a shutaf afilu beozna, then you're pater from Matnas Kehuna. And so in Eretz Israel, they have one Arab who's a shutaf in the ears of all the cattle and the lambs, the shecht over there. It just paters them from it. It is what it is. Ironically, if the Jews aren't eating from the Acharaim, or most of them, or some of them, or all of them, it also kind of patches the problem, because unless it actually belongs to a Jew from beginning to end, in theory, you could get out of it. Over here, and this is what I do, because b'chozot, it's nice to cover bases. Again, if it's a mitzvah d'oraita, we should be careful about it. Here, drop the bad phone call. Here, more often than not, what you have is the slaughterhouses resell the hides, or they tan them, or they more actually what they do is they ship it out to China, where they can tan them with heavy metals and really noxious chemicals. Here we have people are getting insistent. So here you have an environmental protection agency that considers salt to be a groundwater contaminant. So what do? We outsource the pollution. We send it to China and they do whatever they want. But if the goyim own the hides, or if part of the price they're giving you incorporates the resale price of the hide, then already that's your shutvus. So if I'm shechting cattle, I'm not keeping the skins. The slaughterhouse is. They know, I know, and we have an agreement that whatever they're charging me as a kill fee is contingent upon them keeping the hides for themselves. And I'm fine with it. Nothing to do with the hides. You want to tan hides and stink up your neighborhood, you're more than welcome to. But in this day and age, there's ordinances against it. Most municipalities, the whole state of New Jersey, taxidermy is illegal. So, you know, it is what it is. But other than that, I would leave you with this this final note that in practical halacha, just like you'll find anywhere else, these halachic decisions, these halachic distinctions, these chumras and kulas, shitas you can and can't rely upon, they really do have real life consequences. How expensive your meat is going to dictate how many of those people who are on the fringe will spend the extra dollar or two or five or 10 or 20 per pound and maybe bite the bullet on keeping kosher. And maybe they won't. And maybe how frequently and maybe not. And maybe if they raise their kids in a house where this is an issue of priority or importance for them, and maybe not. It's very easy for us as Torah learners and as aspiring Rebbeim, as Talmid Chachamim, should always be Talmid Chachamim, but as aspiring Talmid Chachamim, it's very tempting for us to assume everybody is like us. Everybody shares these priorities. And the reality is they don't. And the more expensive, the more difficult, the more exclusive, the more complicated, and the harder to find, we make kosher meat, or for that matter, any other mitzvah, stam is another good example, the less people will be able to observe them, abide by them, comply with them, at least to some reasonable standard. So a lot more where that came from. I don't want to hold you guys up, and my phone is ringing off the hook. I got to get back to other things. But if anybody wants to follow up, you have any questions, comments, concerns, you ever want to come to the slaughterhouse, we used to do this once, twice a year at YU. We had a great time. We can try to work it out. Usually on Sunday mornings for demonstration purposes. During the week, it's a little bit more complicated because I'm on my own time and I got to go quick. But other than that, feel free to stay in touch. Rav Orlin has my contact information. I'll be happy to put you in touch.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Elkin. We really appreciate your perspectives and your expertise. Hatzlacha Rabba with Bistro Meats. And we're all very appreciative for your time. Thank you, thank you.
Amen, amen, amen. Shavi, productive and spiritual El, and Amit Hashem, a wonderful Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and Sukkot.